Welcome to the latest edition of the New York Jazz Workshop podcast. I'm CJ Shern. Over the years on this podcast, I've been fortunate to interview some of the up-and-coming talents on the jazz scene, such as vocalist Tana Alexa and alto saxophonist Logan Richardson. This trend continues in this episode, where I feature a conversation with the phenomenal Los Angeles-born and bred 22-year-old pianist Connie Hahn, who released her critically acclaimed Mack Avenue debut, Crime Zone, back in October. The album extends a narrative created by the Young Lions movement of the mid-1980s and early to mid-1990s. The Young Lions were a cadre of players including Winton and Branford Marsalis, Mulgrew Miller, James Williams, Terrence Blanchard, Donald Harrison, Wallace Roney, Kenny Garrett, Kenny Kirkland, Ralph Peterson, Steve Coleman, Jerry Allen, and Jeff Tane Watts that gleaned inspiration from the music of both mid-60s Miles Davis and John Coltrane, combined with influences from jazz rock and jazz funk of the 70s. The result was muscular, gritty music that could have happened only in that period of time. The music on records such as Black Codes from the Underground and Live at Blues Alley by Winton Marsalis, Scenes from the City and Bloomington by Branford Marsalis, and Triology by Kenny Garrett influenced several generations of players, including Joshua Redman, the late Roy Hargrove, Christian McBride, among many others. Miss Hahn brings forth a powerful mix of catchy originals, standards, and classic jazz tunes with the support of her working trio featuring Edwin Livingston on bass, Crime Zone co-writer, co-producer, and musical director Bill Wysoski on drums, and on selected tracks, tenor saxophonist Walter Smith III and trumpeter Brian Swartz. Among the topics in this interview include synthesizing Hahn's influences of McCoy Tyner, Kenny Kirkland, and Mulgrew Miller, the pieces on the record, the importance of understanding jazz history, and her feelings on the straight-ahead jazz idiom. My thanks to Connie Hahn for taking time out of a busy schedule for this interview and collaborating with me producing it, and also Gabrielle Holworth at DL Media. Crime Zone. Let's rehash what we were talking about before it started recording and how you got hooked up with Mack Avenue.
Cool. Crime Zone is really meant to communicate how I feel about jazz as an art form, and in this music, straight ahead music specifically, there are so many different pockets and schools of thought within straight ahead jazz that are nuanced and slightly different and also worlds apart, and I like to call them musical fetishes, and mine, I would say, is the Young Lions tradition from the 1990s. And I believe the piano tradition within that particular scene at the time was influenced primarily by McCoy Tyner's interpretation of the tradition. And it's very, it's music that couldn't have existed without the Coltrane Quartet as well as the jazz rock, jazz funk that came out in the 1970s.
Right, exactly what we were talking about, yeah.
And I'm primarily influenced by that, and I would say that that influence is, it sort of comes out organically in that music, you know, on Crime Zone. All the original music was co-written by myself and the producer of the record, Bill Wysoski, who I've known for the past 8 years, and he has been a mentor to me since the beginning of my undertaking of the jazz art form into a collaborator as well as the musical director and drummer of my current trio. And it's really easy to be creative and be inspired to write and arrange this music when you share the common musical fetishes, right? So that would be the Young Lions music inspired a lot from the Wynton Marsalis album, Black Coats from the Underground, as well as a lot of the Branford Marsalis Quartet materials, such as Crazy People Music. And in addition to that, the Mulgrew Miller Wingspan materials, even the Hank Jones Trio record, Upon Reflection, with Elvin Jones and George Mraz, that's in there too.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, that would pretty much sum up Crime Zone. It's me, and a lot of, it comes from me, it comes from my heart, but it's also a tribute to that great tradition. As far as Mac Avenue, the record was really a collaborative effort between Bill Wyzaski and I, in which we were trying to compose material that was forward-thinking, in that we were trying to create edgy music while also paying tribute to the great tradition, specifically the Young Lions. And I would say that a great example of that would be the title track, Crime Zone, where we really stretch it out in terms of the polyrhythm that's going on in the melody. And you're not really sure if this is going to be, like, super modern, but then it kind of smacks you in the face when we get to the blowing section, is going to be a swinging tune. So that tune really encapsulates, in a way, how I feel about this music, where you can still push the envelope while still staying true to your roots. And the blowing section, which Bill came up with, was really inspired by Delphio's Dilemma, I would say. Just overall harmonies, and it's like modal, but it's still moving, and it's first and foremost just, we try to make it all about the feel and the groove and keeping that energy up. That's really our primary goal in this music. And, you know, I like to develop and push toward that goal through the improvisation that's developed between drums and piano, the interaction that happens between drums and piano, because Bill and I, when we met, he made a point of mentoring me and educating me on the importance of the piano drums legacy, where we've got Kenny Kirkland and Jeff Tate Watt, we've got Red Garland and Julie Joe Jones, Chick Corea and Roy Haynes, and those are like dynamics that I've studied pretty thoroughly and trying to understand the differences and how they play together. And that really is one of the biggest driving forces in how I approach playing this music in a small group setting.
Yes, and I would also submit to you Wynton Kelly and Philly Joe Jones on Hank Mobley's Blue Note albums as being a terrific piano drum team as well.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Soul Station, which I just ordered in that audiophile edition that I sent you the link to yesterday, and Workout, which is actually my favorite.
Awesome. Yeah, Soul Station, thank you for mentioning that. That was like one of the first jazz records I ever heard.
Wow.
Wynton Kelly was actually the first piano player I ever transcribed. So, yeah, I mean, Wynton Kelly and Philly Joe Jones, I wish they played together a bit more, because they both have that really snappy, tight eighth note while also still being, like, a little bit loose. Not as much as, obviously, like, McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones, but like that's what made McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones possible, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Crime Zone is all original music, mostly original music that just pays tribute to how I really feel about this art form, that you can still be innovative within the tradition.
Yes, and I was going to say that, too, because in my review, I think I had hinted at some of that. That it's within the language of a particular tradition, but it's still moving forward. And I hear plenty of things in that that's moving forward. And, you know, I hear all the influences that you described, like Kenny Kirkland, Mulgrew, Hank Jones, McCoy. I hear Herbie. I hear Chick. I hear... all of that. But What's so unusual with young musicians is when I hear this record, I can still say, oh yeah, that's Connie Hahn, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I can...
That's good.
Yeah, like I can hear that, oh, it's his voice. And what I had said to you before was that Mulgrew Miller and Kenny Kirkland, there's this linear historical narrative for jazz that is quite limited, and historians don't really look at them. And you were talking about that blog that was written by Nicholas Payton, which I had read, that's saying that Mulgrew Miller was kind of ignored by the jazz establishment to some degree. Not true. I mean, his work with Woody Shaw, Tony Williams especially, is phenomenal. I mean, all those Tony Williams quintet recordings, that's actually like my favorite Tony Williams ever. And I was so thrilled, because I'm also a collector, and I was so thrilled to get a copy of Tokyo Live for only $35 a few years ago, because I had been looking for that for a long time.
Mulgrew, he's primarily known as a sideman, a brilliant sideman.
Yes.
But I think another issue or another problem that occurred when the jazz establishment, you know, they kind of declined in embracing Mulgrew Miller as like a unique voice in that time, is that his band leader records were also overlooked. You know, his band Wingspan with Steve Nelson and Steve Wilson as well.
Yeah, I gotta find those records. Thank you for bringing those up.
Yeah, Kareem Riggins, I believe, on it. Richie Goode, and he's also overlooked as a composer, because he has this knack for composing these very simple yet sophisticated compositions that just serve as such inspiring vehicles for improvisation. And the most important thing about Mulgrew is that he has claimed himself that he's a traditionalist.
Right.
He plays, like, every single time he plays, it's something fresh.
Yes.
Just the way he voices on the piano, it's like no one voices like that. There's, like, this painter element to how he approaches the piano. It's very loose and very open-minded, yet at the same time, it's so rooted in the piano legacy of this music. I almost feel like Mulgrew is like a continuation of what Hank Jones was doing in the interpretation of songbook, like functional songbook harmony, while also still having that influence with McCoy Tyner as well. But Mulgrew was really unique because he was so swinging, and he was one of the loosest players in terms of his eighth note. And he just had this thing. It's pretty hard to explain, but all of the jazz musician community knows it. It's just a shame that he's not more praised in the jazz press, you know.
Well, four of my favorite Mulgrew Miller albums have to be Live at the Kennedy Center, Volume 1 and 2, and Live at Yoshi's. Those records are incredible. And also, Joe Magnarelli, Live at Smalls, which is Mulgrew's final recording.
Oh, okay.
That's really, you know, I'll show that to you one day when we hang out, and I'll play that for you, and you'll be like, wow, that's incredible. But it's Mulgrew's extended intros on that, because Joe gives him some extended intros, and it's just, it's phenomenal. And then, of course, another album I love with Mulgrew is Beyond the Wall by Kenny Garrett.
Yes, me too.
Pharoah Sanders and Bobby Hutcherson. Oh, man, Bob Hurst. Woo, that record is, I love it.
I think there's that song, Shift the Sky. I think that's the name of the tune.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mulgrew takes a great solo on that. I love that record. Wow, thank you for reminding me. I love that record. Mulgrew, especially with his extended intros, like in the pantheon of jazz pianists, take making rubato intros. He's like one of the best, if not the best, in just painting this canvas where you can play whatever you want. But he always puts the melody first while putting mm-hmm. some really interesting, crunchy stuff on it. It's so original, like I say, strongly rooted in the tradition.
Yeah, so, and the Mulgrew influence, too, I want to say, is very, very present on Crime Zone, the title track especially, but also Extended Stay really kind of reminded me of the kind of drive and passion on a tune like Pressing the Issue.
Yeah. One thing I try to prioritize in, absorbing these pianists during my practicing and listening is really trying to understand their touch on the piano and mm-hmm. the way they interpret their eighth notes and their feel. I'm all about feel. I'm all about rhythm. And the way that Mulgrew does it, and also just the way McCoy Tyner does it, which is where I believe a lot of that stuff comes from, is it's so, so powerful. There's so much, like, passion in it. Like, they're not afraid to, make the piano sound, I don't want to say ugly, but, like, I said this before, where if classical pianists were peering over the shoulder of, let's say, Mulgrew Miller or Kenny Kirkland, they'd be like, that's not how you play piano. But that's the style. It's got this grit. It's got this coarseness. And that also comes from, Bud Powell and Art Tatum.
Sure.
That's just jazz piano.
Horace Silver, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, jazz piano in the black tradition, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I think McCoy Tyner put together all that information in a way and that sort of approach to the piano that really revolutionized the straight-ahead jazz piano legacy.
Yeah.
That's why I say that he's responsible for that piano tradition in the Young Lions, which even though Mulgrew didn't play as much with that particular scene, I think there's one record where he plays this with Branford and Tane, Scenes in the City, I think that's the name of the record.
Branford's first record, yeah.
Yeah, pretty crazy. That's like his only experience with those guys. I still consider him to be part of that scene because it's very close in that time period.
Oh, sure, sure.
And, he totally follows that McCoy thing.
Yeah, it's funny. I met Ira Coleman. I was telling you about that gig that I saw Lenny White at. It was, the gig was Pete Levin's Mobius, which is a fantastic group. But Ira Coleman was the bass player and Lenny White was the drummer. And I was talking to Ira Coleman after the gig about just how much I love his work with Tony Williams. And I said to him that music was some of the freshest acoustic jazz of the 1980s and early 90s.
Yeah, and it's sad because that era is, I don't want to say it's overlooked, because I do think it's recognized, but I don't think people perceive that to be anything new. I think people, a lot of the time, it's perceived as a return to the tradition, which it is, but that's all it is.
Right.
If you scratch beneath the surface, they were playing shit that no one was playing. Black Codes is the example of that. Like, no one was writing and arranging tunes like that. Drummers weren't playing jazz drums like that. And that's, the result of the fact that it was influenced, maybe subconsciously or maybe consciously, by the jazz funk and jazz rock of the previous era, because you have to wonder, let's say if McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones were born in the Young Lions era, maybe they would have, their feel, their rhythmic interpretation maybe would have been influenced to sound more like Kenny Kirkland and Jeff Saint Watt.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to say, though, because McCoy Tyner and Elvin Jones made the Young Lions possible, so it's kind of a time travel paradox, so.
Yeah, and before we move on, I just want to add to that. I feel, and I said this in the message to you yesterday, I feel that you can even hear that particular thing on those VSOP Japanese-only records that Herbie Hancock did, like Live Under the Sky and Tempest in the Coliseum. Do you have the complete Herbie Hancock box set on Columbia, the 34 CD?
I should.
Get it, because it's It's amazing, and the booklet is unbelievable. It's like a 200-page booklet. It goes into every detail about the synths and everything he played and all of that. But those records, those acoustic records, they are indicative of that. And at that time period, of which neither you or I were alive when that was happening, but the critics were saying, well, acoustic jazz is back, but when Herbie was doing that in 1976, acoustic jazz never went away. I mean, there was Pablo, there was Concord, there was Xanadu. It's just that those kind of more swinging type things were not as recognized as much as jazz funk and jazz rock. And I don't really use the term fusion personally, because I believe that all jazz is a fusion, and they're restricted to this particular 10, 15 year period of time. It's kind of strange to me.
This is interesting, because I've actually never heard anyone say that about jazz fusion. I mean, especially musicians. You know how jazz fusion, the word is kind of a dirty word among traditionalist purists, right?
Yes.
I think there's a lot of great music in what is considered jazz fusion, and it's a shame that, you know, I've never heard Kenny Kirkland explicitly say this in an interview, but I do believe that Kenny Kirkland was influenced by the fusion playing, as well as the traditional playing of Chick Corea.
Oh, absolutely, because if you listen to Michael Brecker's first album or Sting's records with Kenny, that's explicit. That influence is explicit.
I believe so, and there's clues all around. I mean, Kenny, one of his first sideman appearances in 1979 was with Miroslav from Now He Sings, Now He's Taught.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you know, Kenny, I own this bootleg where Kenny's playing trio with Bob Hurst and Jeff Tane Watson. They play Steps, the first track off of Now He Sings. So all the clues are there. But when you ask him about his influences in one interview, he says Keith Jarrett, Herbie Hancock, and McCoy Tyner. So
yeah.
I was always suspicious of that.
It reminds me of something that Pat Metheny said in an interview fairly recently, where he'll ask young guitar players what their influences are, and he'll hear his own influence, but you know how Pat has, like, literally no ego. He's so humble. He'll hear, like, you know, they'll say, oh, yeah, my influences are, like, Wes Montgomery, George Benson, and Grant Green, and he'll go, like, really? Because, like, he hears himself, you know? And, like, they'll be using, like, the delay and stuff that he kind of pioneered, and it's like, how can that just be Grant Green and George Benson? No, that's also Into the Skull, Frizzell, Metheny, McLaughlin, and onto the Rosenwinkel era, you know?
right. I don't know whether it's because people don't recognize where those sort of aesthetics come from, or because they don't want to say it whatever reason, because this is something that I've talked about with musicians, but I feel that Chick is overlooked also as a traditional player.
Right.
I'm going to go back to him again, and I feel that when people say that they're influenced by Chick, a lot of people mistake that as them being influenced by his fusion stuff, which is not a bad thing, but to a lot of people that is like a question of legitimacy, which is ridiculous.
Right.
But I think people are sometimes afraid to say, like, oh, I'm influenced by Chick, but they'd rather go with the safe influences like Herbie Hancock and Keith Jarrett and McCoy Tyner. Chick's detractors, they say that he's too cold in his feel, like he's a robot or something. And I don't believe that at all. Sure, Chick plays a little cleaner because he has amazing classical piano technique, but his loose approach to rhythm and just the way he improvises, it's so in the vein of like what I love about jazz. Like, he has such a command of the rhythm, and you can hear it especially in his Remembering Bud Powell record.
Oh, yeah, with Kenny Garrett and Wallace Roney and Roy Haynes, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So Chick also got some great sideman work with Bobby Hutcherson on Total Eclipse in 1960-something. I can't remember the exact date.
68 or 69, yeah.
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 But that phrasing is so... It's so Young Lions, to be honest, I have to say. With that said, I don't know what we were talking about.
We were talking about the influences and how you meld them onto the record. I do want to go into a couple of more areas before we wrap things up. First thing is that you are 22 years old and you started playing jazz at the age of 14, and you grew up around Chinese and classical music, things that are kind of diametrically opposite, and your command and feel of this music is astonishing for me. And one thing that really blew me away, and I'm not just saying this is how I really feel, one thing that blew me away was the left hand and bass unisons with Edwin Livingston, because that's such a common device in jazz, but
oh, yeah.
The way you do it is like, that part before your solo on Southern Rebellion, I actually find myself singing that line like all the time, and I don't know why, but it's just so cool.
I'm glad it's memorable. Yeah. Southern Rebellion is an interesting story because, not really a story necessarily, but I wrote initially lines that were supposed to be thinking outside of a piano player, where I was trying to interpret it as if I was like a tenor player playing with a trio, like just bass and drums, and I was trying to just come up with harmonies that were totally... I didn't want to come up with them as if I was approaching it from a piano player side, because I think tenor saxophonists and pianists compose differently just because of how they organize harmony based on their instrumental differences and sometimes even limitations. So when I was writing those lines, I was like, man, I don't know if I can really get this to be like a tenor trio thing, so I'm going to add a little bit of my McCoy Tyner and Kenny Kirkland influence into this and have these really dark, low-end fits, as well as having some linear motion going on the low-end as well. So that's kind of how I came up with that tune. And it was kind of a result of a failure in writing a pianoless trio. So I guess there are great things and failures, right?
Yeah, and then also how you adapt Joe Chambers' line from The Head on A Shade of Jade into the solo piano arrangement. That was like when I initially I saw it on YouTube, but I like when I listened to the version on the album, I had to go back and pull out Mode for Joe and listen to see if that's exactly what he had played, because I hadn't heard that for a while, and sure enough it was. And I'm just like, wow, that's so hip, that's so fresh.
I'm surprised that people don't talk about it more, and I'm also actually surprised that it's not more obvious when you're actually listening. It's absolutely insane for the time that it was recorded in, because the record, Mode for Joe overall, is very straight ahead. It's not like Andrew Hill, right?
Right.
And it's funny because Joe Chambers, he played a lot with Andrew Hill.
Yeah.
But when you hear A Shade of Jade, it sounds like really inside, even when he's playing that polyrhythm. So that's why it's so like when you really listen, actively listen like you did for it, you can hear it. But when you're just absorbing it without looking for it, it just sounds like great modern straight ahead jazz. So when I heard that, I was like, man, Joe Chambers, you are the cat. Like, he interprets the drums like a musician. He's like a real fucking cat, and I really love Joe Chambers for that.
Yeah, do you remember the Ben Sidran interview with Tony Williams where Tony said a lot of people don't expect drummers to be composers, they just expect them to be like savages and give them a piece of meat and just bang on stuff?
I'm not surprised by that at all. And yeah. it's a shame when guys like Joe Chambers and even who I work with, Bill Wazowski, I consider them both very similar in their knowledge of harmony, because Joe Chambers also writes amazingly well. Like, I don't know if you're aware of that record, Now by Bobby Hutcherson.
Yes. Actually, I am aware. Yeah, that's a pretty interesting album, especially the lyrics that Eugene McDaniels writes.
Yeah. Right. Gene McDaniels is, that was actually my first exposure to him, which is silly because he actually went on to become popular for, I think, but Gene McDaniels is much more famous for other things, let's just say.
Yeah, Schoolhouse Rock, right.
Like, not in jazz. Like, he was like a rock and roll guy.
Schoolhouse Rock, yeah, that's what he was famous
right.
for.
And he sings on this Joe Chambers composition, Hello to the Wind, and it is some of the deepest music I've ever heard. I mean, this is just my opinion, because they're not even playing jazz, but it's jazz.
Yeah.
Like, you can hear the black tradition in that music, and you've got Harold Land on there going ballistic, like in the Coltrane vein, but like Harold Land.
Yeah.
But it's like this weird amalgamation of like musical theater and pop. It's very strange. So when I heard that, my respect for Joe Chambers went even higher, even after writing that that arrangement of Shade of Jade. So big props to that guy.
Yeah, and the other tunes. I mean, there's the tunes, I think a lot of people probably talk about these, but Another Kind of Right with its ode to One of Another Kind is fantastic. And then Groovy is, I love that. Especially you kind of nod to Bob James a little bit too, CTI era Bob James.
Yeah.
That's a great tune, because I don't know if people pick this up, but there is a little quote of Dolphin Dance in there a little bit. I don't know if people pick that up, but like when I heard
actually,
that, I thought that was cool.
People have picked it up. I've actually gotten comments from people saying that, and I never wrote that from Dolphin Dance. But that goes to show how great of a tune Dolphin Dance is, which is one of my favorites just because of how compositionally sound it is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Herbie has this talent for composing just these amazing tunes that are not only great vehicles for improvisation, but just as their own in terms of the melodies and the way it develops. It's really a thing of its own. So I'm not really surprised. They're kind of a similar tempo.
Yeah.
And it's actually funny. I don't tell many people this just because it never really comes up, especially now that I play Groovy as a Rhodes tribute to Bob James, which it is, because it's kind of the same tempo, definitely the same key as Westchester Lady. And actually, during our shows, we go into Westchester Lady.
Yeah, I saw the video. Yeah.
Right. But I actually wrote Groovy initially and named the tune after Mulgrew Miller. I wrote Groovy after I was checking out some of Mulgrew's straight eight compositions, such as Farewell to Dogma. Actually, is it Farewell to Dogma? If it's not, it's one of his other ones. It definitely is.
It's not Song for Darnell, I know that, because that's still kind of swinging, you know, waltz, triple meter.
Right, okay, yes, it is Farewell to Dogma. And he plays it with Tony Williams on Tony's trio record, Young at Heart.
I have that right out here on my, in one of my CD cabinets, yes.
Yeah, that's where I discovered it, and I definitely based the way the melody feels and just the overall, like, structure of the tune on what he's doing there. But I realized that this tune was also really effective on Rhodes, and it was also akin to Bob James, which is why jazz is so crazy. This is why jazz is a legacy historical art form, because everything is so relative, mm-hmm. but it's always referencing mm-hmm. something within the canon. I never really tell people that, but it is groovy and named after Mulgrew.
And with the little umlaut thing, that's kind of funny too.
Yeah.
Groovy. Like, you almost think of Alfred Lyon saying it, you know?
Right.
Or like Manfred Eicher or somebody like that.
I love making little inside jokes with my tunes. Or just making... I like to not... Because I take the art form so seriously, I like to name the tunes like something not so epic, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, what I wanted to say too is like, I like your approach, and I like how you use at the beginning the term musical fetishes, because that kind of goes with your MO of being a little bit provocative. And
yeah.
And the album cover, when you look at the album cover, like, I'm a big anime fan, and I looked at the album cover and I was like, oh yeah, she looks like she could be in like Akira or Ghost in the Shell or like Bubblegum Crisis.
Which I need to watch. I am an anime fan too. I wouldn't say that I am an anime aficionado, because I don't know as many animes as I should, but the ones I do like, I love. I love Akira. I love Ghost in the Shell. And I actually just watched a very recent anime, a cyberpunk anime, brilliant one, called Psychopass.
Oh, I'm going to have to check that out.
Please do. It's a brilliant dystopian anime that is masked as a utopia, where there is a central brain that essentially decides on whether people are psychologically fit to function in society. And it's just a really amazing exploration of, like, morality. There's a way to quantify someone's likeliness to commit murders and commit crimes and to be essentially a bad person.
Right.
And it's just really, really great. It's really relevant to these days where we let technology automate a lot of decisions. And it, mm-hmm. and in that anime, mm-hmm. it like gets to the point where machines, not necessarily machines, I don't want to give it away, but just non-humans are deciding on whether people are making the right decisions. So it's a really great anime, and I like to express my other interests, you know, through that album artwork, because as much of a jazz geek, jazz nerd that I am, I also really love fashion, and I love the aesthetic of cyberpunk.
Oh, yeah, wow.
I love Japanese culture. Like, that's really cool.
Me too. Me too. I'm an absolute, I'm a Japanese freak. We'll talk about that after the interview. But yeah, I totally could relate. But the last thing I want to touch on before we end the interview is, for me, women in jazz now is, women's position in jazz is brighter than it's ever been. And, you know, you see women like Tia Fuller and Camille Thurman and yourself and Hiromi Uehara really playing their hearts out. It's not just women are relegated to the role of vocalist. And you are also Asian American too. And I feel like you provide a lot of inspiration towards Asian American women possibly who may be looking to be jazz pianists. So talk about your feelings on that.
I'm happy to be a role model. That's how I look at it. I try to not let my identity in the things that I have no choice over,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
is being a woman and being an Asian American, influence how I approach my art.
Yeah.
Because I want to keep everything merit-based. That's all what I'm about.
Right, right.
But I'm more than happy to serve as a role model for those people, because, yeah, there aren't that many of us. But, you know, I will also say from a business standpoint and a marketing standpoint that that also makes makes someone, I guess, of my demographic a little bit more lucrative even in jazz music, because we are just not as common. So it's a little bit interesting, I have to say. But I try to not let that define what I do because there is definitely a push to include more women and more Asian Americans in jazz, and I think there needs to be a good balance between doing that, not doing that artificially.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So, totally.
I love Linda Oh, because I think she takes that sort of approach where it's really just about the music and the role model aspect of it sort of just comes organically, you know?
Yeah, the same thing with Antonio Sanchez, who's a really good friend of mine. He doesn't let his identity dictate. I mean, his new album, which is coming out January 25th, it's called Lines in the Sand. It's a powerful statement on being an immigrant in America. And, you know, it's not about him necessarily as a Mexican who's now a citizen of America, but it's for everybody, you know, who's an immigrant. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't let that totally define things 100%, but, you know, I love how you say that, because Linda Mahan Oh, she's also going purely about the music, and you talk about not letting something define you. I have a physical disability, and you probably don't see too many people writing about jazz who are in, like, wheelchairs and open about them having a disability.
Brilliant, by the way. So, I mean, you should... People who contribute as much to jazz journalism like you, in which there just aren't that many, I encounter too many people who are given these positions who are not nearly as informed. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter if you're in a wheelchair, because it's all about your contribution. Mm-hmm. And just your value as a person, you know, and taking control of your destiny and taking control of the things that you can do, even taking advantage of the things that you don't have control over. I mean, I think there is a very rich market for Asian American female jazz pianists, and I will say this explicitly because there simply aren't that many playing.
Right.
Straight ahead jazz. So I think that might even also draw people who might not even be interested in jazz music.
They
might just be interested in the aesthetic, because I'm also all about aesthetic. What I find in jazz is that there are many brilliant players, but watching some people on the bandstand dress in suits all the time, that can get a little bit boring.
Yeah.
I like to spice things up.
Yeah, man. Totally.
Jazz is a provocative art form. It's sexy. It used to be about sex. Like, it used to be about, like, being sensual, being mysterious. There was a very noir sort of feeling to it. And now I feel some of it has been sterilized due to the formalization of it in jazz education. And it's just become sort of like America's classical music. So people dress that way. People talk about it in a very sterilized way. And even though I'm all about the tradition and a lot of the stuff I value falls in line with that kind of culture, at the same time, I also want to still be kind of edgy, kind of cool, you know? Because that's what jazz is. I mean, look at Roy Hargrove and how he dressed on stage. It was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm still feeling that loss incredibly because... I got into him when I was like 13 years old, and I said to another one of my mentors in the music department where I went to high school, I said, he is my generation's Lee Morgan, and Roy Hargrove just passed away. I had no idea when I said that what kind of connotation that would have, because he really did sort of, his fire as a player, his swagger, all of that, totally reminiscent of Lee Morgan.
You were totally right there. He was reminiscent of the, I think, the equivalent tradition in piano that I like, but in trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
He was, like, the perfect fusion of that, like, tough guy trumpet where there's swagger, but it's got so much, like, respect to the tradition. Lee Morgan, Freddie Hubbard, like endless bebop vocabulary, but he's got that soul and that modern edginess that made straight ahead music sound super fresh.
Yeah,
he dressed that way too.
Oh, so, absolutely.
I mean, he was a cat. I mean, really, really just amazing bridge of generations, I would say.
Right.
I guess I would say after the fact he's kind of an influence in that way.
Oh, sure.
It's a shame that he passed like how the jazz musicians, you know, live fast, die young. He's way too young for 2018. 2018 people are wearing flip-flops and eating vegan food, and he's living fast. I'm not saying that you should do that. I'm not advocating that, but really absorb that jazz musician lifestyle that has been romanticized in popular culture, I would say.
Well, to me, and even just being a fan of the music, even though I do sing a little bit now, but I would say that jazz is, it's not just a form of music for me. It is a lifestyle. And even
100% agree with that.
Even just getting up 20 minutes before noon, that's kind of like a jazz thing, because I'm always up till like 3 or 4 in the morning, and then sometimes I'll do like writing then, and then like I'll go to bed, I'll be listening to music all night, whatever, but yeah, totally. So, before we wrap this up, where can people find you on the web?
You can find me at ConnieHahn.com, or you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at my handle, which is at ConnieHahnJazz, one word.
And Connie, this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, CJ, for having me.
If you are interested in learning more about the influences of Connie Hahn, you can take classes at the New York Jazz Workshop, such as the Bebop Workshop, taught by Andrea Veneziani, From Bebop to Hardbop, taught by Mark Sherman, and the Modern Jazz Ensemble Workshop, taught by Sebastian Noel, which will give you the tools to understand the types of language and vernacular that Ms. Hahn spoke about in this interview. For the New York Jazz Workshop podcast, I'm CJ Shern. Peace, love, groove, and keep swinging, everybody.